Good morning and good evening, depending
both
on where
at the same time. Where we are.
Both at the same time.
Yes.
By the marvels of modern technology.
Yes.
So, KG, it is so nice to be with you again today.
Thank you.
To resume our exploration of new synthesis of yoga for overcoming the impasse of modernity, which is the topic that we are considering.
Yeah.
And I wanted to touch on some of the things you introduced last time.
Yeah.
And also make a comment and then continue for today.
Yes.
I have circulated rather late, I think, last night, the passage from the Life Divine that you spoke about last time.
Yeah, I received a copy of it.
All right.
And I received it.
Okay, thank you. And just to touch on what you introduced, you started with three of the major difficulties that lies in our path today. The first is the hugeness of machinery and the complexity of machinery in which we seem to be enmeshed in a variety of ways today. We are conditioned by very large systems of machinery, both visible and invisible. The second one was the two principal sort of faculties or properties, qualities of the human being that seem to be the principal ways by which we define ourselves and which we are utilizing to deal with our world. And these are egoism and rationality. And you touched on the fact that one of the great difficulties of our modern age is that at some level we feel distinctly the limits of both of these, but there is also a complete refusal to go beyond them.
That's right.
So you about the limitation or reduction of the human ideal to a kind of a economic ideal of life. Focus on economism or a kind of concentration sphere.
Hello. Yes.
Hello. Yes.
I can.
So, yes. These were three of the forms of Western currency that you touched on last time.
Yes.
And then you also pointed to the fact that right from maybe the early beginnings of the modern age, from the time of the French Revolution, philosophers like Immanuel Kant, you've had a sense of the limits of these problems, particularly the problems of egoism and rationality, and looking for some other kind of principle by which we may live our life. And we may say that this kind of a philosophical impasse is also sensed very acutely by postmodern philosophers today.
Yeah.
But it seems that both the problem of machinery, of being conditioned, of being made into subjects by invisible forms of machinery, as well as the problem of limits of the reason, are very acutely understood and seen by some of the postmodern philosophers who have gone far as to claim themselves to be anti-humanist as a result.
Yes.
But apparently, somehow, they have not been able to find a solution. They recognize that, and they may point to a solution, but the science of an alternate life or alternate way of overcoming this has not been evident to any of them. This was one comment I wanted to make. And The other thing that you introduced from the Life Divine were the four kinds of ways or the four solutions that the human mind or the modern mind has devised toward the overcoming of the problem between the of the harmony between the individual and the collective.
Yes.
That man and society and their relationship is one of the major problems, and particularly in today's world, which has become so very interdependent, this is a very, very major problem. And so what has humanity done to address this problem? And you looked at the four solutions that Sri Aurobindo has introduced. Actually, you just touched on them because we were at the end of our period by then.
Yes, yes.
And these four solutions are what I have circulated to the whole group to
yes.
briefly summarize.
Three of them.
But in a sense, he starts with the search for a perfect economic society by the powers of reason and science.
Yes.
And he moves on in that very same paragraph to talk about the reaction to this coming to a kind of submergence of the individual ego in what being considered as a nation soul. But nation soul that is more like a blind life impulse and a kind of a submergence into some sort of, retrogression of consciousness. Then the other one that introduces is a kind of internationalism and a way by which, again, the ego is coerced into some sort of a what Sri Aurobindo calls the possibility of a termite civilization.
Yes.
Yes. And then the next one he considers is not so much the submergence of the individual by coercion, but in a sense by consent. So by processes of the enlightenment of the will and the reason through education, through socialization, we may arrive at a certain kind of a consent of the individual to agree to the process of social perfectibility and putting their shoulder, as it were, to the wheel of human progress. And so these are the four that Sri Aurobindo introduces, these are the three with proceeding from the first that he introduces.
Mm.
And I wanted to make a brief comment about this, that when Sri Aurobindo was writing this this paragraph, this chapter and this paragraph, it was just after the Second World War. It was revised, apparently, this part.
Yes, yes.
And so he can, for one, the specter of the rise of false subjectivism, of a very dangerous kind of nationalism, was still pretty much in the air.
Yeah.
As an aftermath of the Second World War. And so when he's talking about the nation soul over there and the dangers of misunderstanding the nation soul, this is very much what he's thinking about. Yeah. Now, in today's world, to some extent, perhaps this danger does not exist in the same way, because there is a suspicion regarding this idea of nationalism to this degree of the submergence of the individual. But at the same time, it may have risen in another form, in that we find that, a large number of irrational philosophies and religions are now making their claim as a reaction to this rational drive for progress.
Mm-hmm.
And whether fundamentalist Islam or a variety of cults, in America we find so many cults, including cults based on Hindu gurus, etc.,
yes,
that seem to offer some kind of non-rational solution, but they are all extremely limited, and in some ways they all demand some kind of orthodoxy. Unquestioning belief. It's a surrender to some sort of unquestioned, non-rational form of living. So I wanted to just touch on that, Kiriji.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. And then,
well, like other, to...
Yeah, one more, Kiriji, I just.
Yes.
And that is, the specter of you know, of the submergence of the individual into the socialist state, which is the second one that he is introducing there.
Yeah.
That to some extent seems to be either aborted or at least displaced. So we have now that particular kind of machinery, the machinery of socialism, that has been replaced now to some extent by a different kind of machinery which seems to give the individual greater freedom, but actually conditions the individual and even gives the various kinds of lifestyles and desires by which the individual may live through very subtle methods of propaganda and of market control. So I wanted to sort of touch on that as well. And then, you know, so we are left in a condition where today machinery seems to have become rather subtle, but it is still very much controlling us. And even the forms of education that we have today are really forms of control by which subjectivities are manufactured, so that we become certain kinds of people who push the wheel of progress in a rational and in a sort of a egoistic manner. And we still see that total refusal to move into a higher domain of consciousness or even recognize the impasse. Sorry for taking this long time.
It's very good, I think. You made 3 points, and if you allow me, I shall first touch upon these 3 points. Is that all right? It will be an order?
Yes. Please, yes.
Well, I would summarize your points by saying first that we are all trying to become very precise about what I may call the nerve of the impasse of today. You know, there are so many ideas which have now come up before us, and it is quite possible that we may lose the nerve of the impasse while speaking of many ideas. So let me first of all, before returning to these 3 points that you mentioned, let me preface the reaction to your 3 comments by recapturing 3 important points which need to be kept in view while examining the present impasse. The first premise of the whole argument is that human nature is complex. We will not be able to get the nerve of the impasse unless we start with the statement that human nature is complex. And as Sri Aurobindo has explained, and which I had also quoted in full, where Sri Aurobindo speaks of the physical, vital, mental, spiritual conglomeration in every individual and in the social fabric, these 4 points, and the way in which they are all interwoven, And that is what makes our nature and its movement very complex. That's the first point. The second point is that there has been in the history of mankind a constant struggle to bring about some kind of a relationship between the individual and the collectivity into some kind of a harmony or perfection. And the whole history of mankind, as I had said, can be read in the light of the constant conflict between the individual and the collectivity and the efforts made by the human race to bring these two terms into some kind of accommodation. The third point is, I have not referred to it up till now, but I would like to present to you one paragraph once again from Sri Aurobindo, and this is from the Human Cycle, which also I would like to read out because that also is a necessary part of the premise on which we are working, where Sri Aurobindo speaks of the three stages of the human cycle. This is on page number 173 of the Human Cycle, volume number 15 of the Centenary Edition. And I will read that one paragraph in which once again Sri Aurobindo has summarized the whole history of humankind and emphasized three stages of this human cycle corresponding to three basic elements in the human being, the infrarational, the rational, and the suprarational, or physical vital on the one hand, the mental in the middle, and then the higher spiritual, of which Sri Aurobindo has spoken in his description of the complexity of the human nature. Now in this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo speaks of the social development going through these following three stages. And let me read out to you that particular paragraph where Sri Aurobindo says, we have seen that there are necessarily three stages of the social evolution, or generally of the human evolution in both individual and society. Our evolution starts with an infrarational stage in which men have not yet learned to refer their life and action in its principles and its forms to the judgment of the clarified intelligence. For they still act principally out of their instincts, impulses, spontaneous ideas, vital intuitions, or else obey a customary response to desire, need, and circumstance. It is these things that are canalized or crystallized in the social institutions. Man proceeds by various stages out of these beginnings towards a rational stage in which his intelligent will, more or less developed, becomes the judge, arbiter, and presiding motive of his thought, feeling, and action, the molder, destroyer, and recreator of his leading ideas, aims, and institutions. Finally, if our analysis and forecasts are correct, the human evolution must move through a subjective towards a suprarational or spiritual age in which he will develop progressively a greater spiritual, supra-intellectual, and intuitive, perhaps in the end, a more than intuitive, a Gnostic consciousness. He will be able to perceive a higher divine end, a divine sanction, a divine light of guidance for all he seeks to be, think, feel, and do, and able to more and more to obey and live in this larger light and power. That will not be done by any rule or of intrarational religious impulse and ecstasy, such as characterized or rather darkly illumined the obscure confusion and brute violence of the Middle Ages, but by a higher spiritual living for which the clarities of the reason are a necessary preparation and into which they too will be taken up, transformed, brought to their invisible source. This is the paragraph in which Aurobindo describes three stages through which human cycle will proceed, two of the stages of which first, of course, has been completed, the second is about to be ended, third is about to begin. This is Sri Aurobindo's statement. Now, if you read these three premises which I have put before, we shall be able to get the real nerve of the impasse. And the three points that you have raised in your comment can be better dealt with in the light of this precision that you may arrive at. The important point is that if human nature were not complex, if the human nature had not to pass through stages of development in a complex manner, and if there was not a great difficulty in relating individual and the collectivity, probably our historical development of humankind or even of evolution would have been much smoother and much more rapid. But these three premises which have been laid down here indicate that our process is rather difficult. Why it should be so difficult, apart from the complexity of human nature and so on, has another premise, and that is Sri Aurobindo's entire theory of evolution, to which we shall have time to refer later on. But that also is a fact, that there is today an evolutionary process, and it is because of the evolutionary process that there is a groping movement. And this groping movement is a characteristic of the entire history of mankind. In this groping movement, it is not easy to forecast what exactly will happen. You might say certain stages can be more or less pre-said, but the movement is a groping movement and there is a lot of possibilities. Now, in that context, because there is groping movement and there are many possibilities, what has actually happened is that the rationalistic age, which began particularly with the Renaissance through Reformation and so on, that movement had a kind of a checkered movement. And it is that checkered movement of which postmodernism today is a culminating point. And we shall come to this checkered movement presently. In that checkered movement, there has been enormous development of human consciousness on certain lines. And this enormous development has not been matched by development of other parts of our consciousness. And because of the mismatch, the impasse has been created. And this is one point I would like to make very precise, that the root cause of the impasse is this, that there has been, particularly with the development of science, which has produced huge structures of organization, this has not been matched by the development of those elements of reason and inner consciousness of morality and aesthetics and other aspects of consciousness and spiritual element, these have not meshed with the movement of science and the huge structures it has constructed. This mismatch is the reason for the present impasse. Now, even this impasse, even this difficulty would not have mattered very much if certain thing had not to happen. But it has happened. Certain thing could have happened. It could have been avoided, but it has happened. And that is the humanity's preponderance for organization of economic life. Now, I would say that this was not an inevitable development. It could have been avoided if reason had to develop in a different way, not in the way in which it has developed so far. As I said, checkered movement of the rational development. The emergence of the economic man, the vital man, the materialistic man, was always a possibility. The emergence of barbarism has always been a factor in the human civilization. And at this stage of human development, perhaps this could have been avoided, but it has surged. And in a tremendously powerful manner, as Sri Aurobindo says, in the civilized form of human society, which rational development of man had led us to, has been crossed by a very powerful assertion of the economic man, vitalistic man, and by the powers of the science and hugeness of structure, which can be put at the service of the economic man and the economic perfection of social development. This barbarism, which has arisen now, it is that which has caused the precise point of the impasse. Can you repeat your third point which you had mentioned?
Yes, Kiriji. Basically, it was these points. You have actually addressed the third point in addressing the second. The point I was making over there is that exactly as you said, it is a social organization through machinery that capitalism also represents, but in a way it is more insidious, more invisible, and it appears to release the individual to a certain kind of freedom. But it's a illusionistic freedom because it really controls the individual through the conscience, through the creation of the subject. It makes us or manufactures us into certain kinds of desiring beings who have a certain type of prospect in front of us of a lifestyle and also a kind of a adherence to the progress of reason. But we do this sort of in a invisible way that through education, through socialization, we are meant to feel, made to feel as if we have chosen this path. But it has actually been chosen for us. So it is the individual, freedom of choice, which at a deeper level is in some sense controlled. Rather than being coerced from outside by machinery, it is like a virus. The machinery has gone inside us and has created us into a rational and egoistic, desiring being of the neoliberalist global world order. That was what I was.
I think you have covered the point quite well, and I would like to sum up this our discussion by pointing out that the nerve of the impasse is the development of rationality, reaching up to a certain point and getting arrested, as in postmodernism today, and getting arrested on another line in the experiments which have been made on three ideals which reason has put forward, namely liberty, equality, and fraternity. And last several centuries have proved that these three ideals which reason demands should be perfectly synthesized and harmonized cannot be harmonized. When liberty is allowed, equality is murdered. When equality is attempted, liberty is strangulated. And as far as brotherhood is concerned, that is hardly at all in the picture except in ideas and on a kind of a lip service. This is another line on which our reason today stands erected, and we do not really know how we can create a social structure which can fulfill all the three ideals together. And both these, actually, the present postmodernism, and secondly, the arrestation of the experimentation in regard to liberty, equality, and fraternity, the arrestation of these two movements, or the arrestation of the reason, movement of reason on two lines combined together, is a nerve of the impasse. If we can move forward after this, and today we are exactly at this point, we are now circling round and round and round, and it's a perilous movement round and round because of the fact that the economic man, the barbarian, has come forward as the most important element in the situation. So you might say that this is the impasse to which we have reached. And I would like to now move forward to the fourth point that Sri Aurobindo had suggested would be likely, namely solution of the religion, which has already now been advocated, which has already come into the forefront, and it is that point which I would like to consider before moving forward, because even this solution which is being put forward by many, which would declare that reason has failed, let us leave aside reason and let us try to build a society on some other grounds, namely the grounds of religion. Now, this solution that is being put forward requires to be formulated more clearly. And I should like to refer to a few lines in the Life Divine on page number 1058, where Sri Aurobindo has very precisely stated what exactly is a solution that is being put forward on the side of religion. Sri Aurobindo says, there is a possibility that in the swing back from a mechanistic idea of life and society, the human mind may seek refuge in a return to the religious idea and a society governed or sanctioned by religion. I think this is a very powerful statement, and although this proposition has not absolutely been put forward in this precise form, But there is a very big movement today in the world where there is a formula, return to the basics. Return to the value. And there is a tremendous urge among human beings today to find certainty and to escape this kind of uncertainty which has arisen all over, not only in the mental field, but also uncertainty on account of factors like warming of the earth and so on. Religion seems to be giving to mankind a kind of a message. This message has three aspects. One, that reason is not the provider of knowledge that human being requires for his journey. Secondly, that there is another source of knowledge, namely revelation. And this revelation cannot be questioned. And if mankind wants to be guided, it has to accept the truth revealed by revelation. And thirdly, that there is a rule of conduct which is implied in the revelation, which if followed by human beings would give to the individuals a kind of a fulfillment and even a possibility of a perfect social living. These three propositions are involved in the call of religion. Now, on this subject, Sri Aurobindo has written at length. And in the human cycle particularly, Sri Aurobindo has spoken of the reason and religion. One full chapter has been given by Sri Aurobindo, entitled Reason and Religion. This is chapter number 13 of the Human Cycle. It is part of the volume 15 of the Centenary Edition. And he has also given another chapter, and that is the chapter entitled Religion as the Law of Life. And that is chapter number 17 in the Human Cycle. It is not my intention to go into these two chapters. I will simply state one sentence from the Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo says that organized religion, though it can provide a means of inner uplift for the individual and preserve in it or behind it a way for his opening to spiritual experience, has not changed human life and society. It could not do so because in governing society, it had to compromise with the lower parts of life and could not insist on the inner change of the whole being. It could insist only on a credal adherence, a formal acceptance of its ethical standards, and a conformity to institution, ceremony, and ritual. There is today, however, a more difficult situation that we are facing. and that is a claim of certain religions to spread over the whole humanity and to convert the whole humanity into the fold of one religion or the other. That is to say, to seek the unity of mankind by unifying all the people under the umbrella of one particular religion. And since several religions are doing the same thing or trying to do the same thing, there is a tremendous rivalry among these religions. And you might say that there is at present a possibility, or even partially even speaking, actuality of the conflict of religions in full swing. And this is one stage through which I think humanity has to pass, unless something else happens and we can minimize the perils that this conflict of religions would pose to mankind. It is better, therefore, that humanity comes to study the problem of religion in its fullness, realize what religion can do, what religion cannot do, and how one can transcend the necessity of returning to religions. According to Sri Aurobindo, this can be done, first of all, by pointing out that reliance upon dogma, which is the kernel of many religions and which are sharply in conflict with each other, cannot give the solution that humanity is seeking. That is to say, first of all, we have to understand the role of dogma and religion. Secondly, we have to realize that no religion can uplift a social life. A given religion can uplift individuals, a few individuals, or even many individuals. But human nature being very varied, has a tremendous variety of human consciousness. It is impossible that any one particular religion will be able to unify humanity and can uplift humanity. And the third point is that whatever religio-ethical practice that can be proposed cannot transform, cannot really uplift. It can purify to some extent. It can control to some extent. And very often, religions are obliged to turn into some kind of asceticism, a world-negating affirmation in which the world is condemned to be meaningless ultimately, or a compromise in which a religious life and ordinary life both are allowed to some extent to live side by side. As a result, there is no solution. That is why Sri Aurobindo says, and this is again on page number 1059, a total spiritual direction given to the whole life and the whole nature can alone lift humanity beyond itself. It is only the full emergence of the soul, the full descent of the native light and power of the spirit, and the consequent replacement or transformation and uplifting of our insufficient mental and vital nature by a spiritual and supramental supernature that can effect this evolutionary miracle. Well, this is the conclusion to which our study could lead of the exact point of impasse and the manner by which that impasse can be crossed. And now Sri Aurobindo has said that this insistence upon the spiritual solution is not likely to be easily accepted. Sri Aurobindo himself has pointed out that at first sight, this insistence on a radical change of nature might seem to put off all the hope of humanity to a distant evolutionary future. Humanity is always demanding a solution and solution right now, and anything that is put off for the future is considered to be a bright dream, but of no practical utility. It is this important point that we need to dwell upon, and I think it is already 8:15 now in my watch, and maybe that I can stop here for the moment and ask if there are any comments or questions on whatever I have said so far. Debashish, would you like to make any comment, or some other friends who are listening to this would like to make a comment?
Thank you so much, Kiritji. I think I will defer and allow somebody else, since I've already spoken quite a big bit in the beginning. If anybody else
very important
wishes to, I think what you have presented is very, very potent and powerful and consideration. Particularly this entire very, very important chapter on religion and the dangers that it presents to us today as a possible sort of half-baked solution out of our rational impasse. So I will, pass on and allow anybody who wants to ask questions to go ahead and explore
Fine.
This further. Thank you.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah. What is your name?
Oh, this is Vincent Massa.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I found your talk for me extremely illuminating. It's just put into form a lot of what I've been. It's made it easier for me to understand and put into the context of Sri Aurobindo what is happening in the world, and that's a wonderful thing. Anyways, thank you very much.
Happy to hear that. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I just wish I could put. I just wished I had more knowledge to put that into. To draw on as you do. It seems so familiar, and it Sri Aurobindo's writings seem so real to you. You have that ability, as does Devashish, to recall all that. I just wished I can do that, or at some point be able to do that myself. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I would like to make a short comment on what you said just now. In fact, you know, there was a very interesting question which was asked to the mother when the works of Sri Aurobindo were being proposed to be taught in our center of education at Pondicherry between 1959 to 1973. We put many questions to the mother on how to teach our students. And almost every day there was some illumination coming from the mother. And one of the questions was put to her was, how shall we teach works of Sri Aurobindo to the students? There were many debates among teachers. All right.
Yes, yes.
You see, it was a very interesting question. Some people were saying we should not teach Sri Aurobindo at all. Because who can teach Sri Aurobindo? Some others said, no, we should at least do something about them because such a big treasure available to all of us and our center of education is dedicated to Sri Aurobindo. And if Sri Aurobindo is not taught at this center, where can it be taught? In any case, many people felt that our students at least should know about Sri Aurobindo and should know about Sri Aurobindo quite well. And if so, how can it be done? Some people thought that only mother should be requested to teach Sri Aurobindo's works and nobody else. A question was put to the mother by a teacher saying, mother, as far as spiritual teaching is concerned, only mothers should teach our children. And other teachers in the school should teach only physics, chemistry, biology, all that is concerning the world. And mother answered that you are still making a big division between spirituality and earthly lives. She said, what is not spiritual? And she went to say that everything that is to be taught, whether it's mathematics or physics or chemistry or biology or geography or history, all that is a vibration of the spirit. And then she dwelt on this at length, and it made a tremendous impact upon the teachers of our center of education. Another question which was put was, mother, how shall we teach a given book of Sri Aurobindo? Our teacher said, shall I read one passage from Sri Aurobindo and then all sit meditation on that paragraph? Or shall we not even read, but only go to the class, open the book and tell students, you read this paragraph silently and we all meditate on it? Or shall we explain what Sri Aurobindo has said? These are alternatives put to the mother. And mother said that teacher should not be a screen between Sri Aurobindo and the student. That is to say, the teacher should not act as a kind of a glass, as a screen which can stop some kind of passage that comes of the light that comes from Sri Aurobindo, which is passing towards students. The role of the teacher, Mother said, is that the teacher gives a full background of the problem that Sri Aurobindo is dealing with in a given book or a given passage to which we want to refer. And that background should lead the students to the presence of a problem in all its acuteness. So the students are led to seek the solution for it. And then you should present the solution as Sri Aurobindo has given. But in presenting the solution of Sri Aurobindo, care must be taken to see that the teacher does not become a screen. You may read, Mother said, you may read a passage of Sri Aurobindo, you can point out whatever you want to point out, but the passage of Sri Aurobindo should come as an illumination to the students in which the solution is found by them. In another context, when this question was put to the mother, she said, Sri Aurobindo should not be read book by book, but you should be able to take a problem and bring whatever Sri Aurobindo has written in different books on the same subject and present to the students a coordinated picture of what Sri Aurobindo said on that subject. Well, these are the things that Mother spoke of, and in my own life, I have tried to follow this to the extent to which my effort could provide. And that is the reason why I began to read Sri Aurobindo in a different manner. And that is why somewhat you might find in my exposition some reflection of what effort I have made. But I must tell you that I am extremely aware of my inadequacy, and I very much hesitate whenever I speak of Sri Aurobindo. And I always pray to the mother that I do not become a screen in any way. And those who read, those who are with me and reading with me Sri Aurobindo, should really get directly what Sri Aurobindo has said. So you will pardon me if I am, actually I always, after doing my work on any book on Sri Aurobindo, if I speak about it, I always go to Sri Aurobindo and say, please pardon me. I have distorted what you wanted to say, but let it be now covered by you, and you kindly clear the path. And let all those who have heard me today read you directly and receive from you directly what you have to say to them. So when you made this comment, I feel inspired to tell you my inner story to this extent.
Well, thank you. I think that your teaching is wonderful. I personally think of myself as the student. I don't think ever of being a teacher. I just think of being a student forever. There's so much to learn from Sri Aurobindo. For so many years, I just sat there at the samadhi, and I just didn't do anything, just sat and felt it all. And it, maybe now, years and years later, it's starting to come out as a need to put intellectual form to what I learned, or my inner place in me learned. But thank you. That was just extremely wonderful to me. Yeah.
Thank you.
Kirit Bhai.
Yes.
If I may, sort of ask a question or raise a certain sort of area for illumination, because this is a very vast area, and I hope that even
in our next meeting, we can continue to deal with it to some extent. But in one of my conversations with you, when I was at Delhi, I recollect something you said, which may have some bearing on this issue of religion, and even on the issue the movement of the teaching of Sri Aurobindo and the people who follow Sri Aurobindo today. Remember you talking about a variety, as you said, man is a complex being, and a variety of inner faculties which are necessary even for emerging into a spiritual life. And you mentioned that often this religious path begins with a psychic enthusiasm. And often it stays stuck at the level of a psychic enthusiasm without a sufficient amount of rational precision coming into play or becoming part of the journey. Would you like to comment on this as maybe one of the promising beginning, but something which may actually become arrested and fall into the trap of religion?
Well, I think I'm very happy to receive this question from you. It is true that when we discussed this question in our Delhi meeting, I have always felt that there is a tendency among many of us to belittle the role of the reason. In fact, belittling the role of reason has been a special characteristic of religion. Now, it is true that in the writings of Sri Aurobindo the Mother, there is a very great emphasis in a statement, don't be too mental. And this statement is often greatly satisfying to many people who do not want to make a mental effort. But as Mother and Sri Aurobindo have said, do not make their statements as a dogma. They have said exactly the opposite also, when they have said, don't be too mental, they also underlined the necessity of mental development and a very vast development of the mind. That statement, don't be too mental, is for people who have really developed a vast intellectuality and who have become stuck in intellectuality, and it has become a kind of an obstacle to their opening to higher faculties of consciousness. But for the people who have not yet developed the muscles of the intellect, I think Mother's message for intellectual development is very clear. If you read Mother's book called On Education, there is one full chapter on the mental education. And I think in a short chapter, she has underlined the tremendous importance of mental development. And she has said that mind should develop clarity, complexity, power of analysis, power of synthesis, power of concentration, and power to be silent whenever you want to be silent, and open up the mind to knowledge. I think this is the most powerful and most concise statement on what is expected all of us to develop. Mental education is very important. And as against the religion, you said that sometimes there is a danger of falling into the trap of the narrowness of religion. And that danger should be always kept in view so that we may not fall into that danger. And that is why, in fact, the Rishi Aurobindo and to most of us, she said we should read the Life Divine and the Synthesis of Yoga, and you can realize what a tremendous mental development is needed. When Mother said, to be able to read the Life Divine, you have to prepare for 10 years as a preparation. Then you can read the Life Divine. So I think if you keep in mind this aspect, we shall be protected from falling into this trap. And I think we all need to understand this. There is also another point I would like to refer to, and that is, there is a very important chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga where Sri Aurobindo speaks of intuitive minds, in which he describes four methods by which one can grow into the intuitive mind. And he says that all the four are to be combined. It is not as if four are optional methods. Although, in your development, you may use one or the other to begin with, but gradually all the four methods have to be developed. And one of the four methods is perfection of the intellectual faculty. It is itself a method of entering into intuitive mind. The other method, of course, is of silencing the mind, which is also necessary. The third method is the development of offering one's consciousness to the divine. And the fourth method is to lift our entire consciousness and to make it fixed into Sahasrara, into the highest chakra, which is on the head of the crown of the brain, and to open it up from there. And all the four methods are important. And in our yoga, I think we need to develop all the four methods. And from that point of view, even the kind of reading and study we are doing is part of that yoga. And we are trying to open up through the development of intellectual faculty and also many other things which are going on at the same time, to open up to intuitive consciousness. Is it all right as my answer to your question?
Yes, yes, Kiriji. Thank you so much.
If you don't have a question, I can put a question. Is it allowed?
Yes, certainly.
You know, this problem that I am exploring with all of us here is a problem which requires a study of the human cycle, the Life Divine, Synthesis of Yoga, and also that great book called The Supramental Manifestation on the Earth. And I do not know if our friends who are here, I can get a background as to how much of these four books they are acquainted, so that, you know, whenever I come here on Friday evening on this table, I ask myself whether I'm not taking too much of your time in expounding certain things. But if I knew that you have already a background of this or that, it will help me to modulate myself and to not to bother you too much with something that you do not wish to enter into. Now, is it possible for me to have from each one of you some kind of an idea as to how much you think I should be dealing in regard to these books, and what kind of treatment would you like me to follow? So that, you know, I am always aware that everybody has pressure of time, and I should not encroach upon of anyone, and one should not feel that somebody's time is wasted. I would like to therefore to understand how much I should talk, and on what to talk, and to what extent you would like this to go on, because this topic is of such a large measure that one can go on for one full year, or one can finish in three lectures or four lectures, because I want to receive from you as to what extent whether you would like to finish exposure in the next two lectures or next three, four lectures, or what is your measure. I'd be happy to learn about it so that I can summarize or I can expand according to what you would like to have. Anybody to answer this question?
Well, if no one else, I mean, I certainly have an answer. I like the form of it very much. And speaking for myself, I feel that the time we have is short. I have, you know, lots of free time, so it may not be very representative, but I really like the format that we have, and I hate to put it into any limited type of framework. The pace at which Debashis teaches, for instance, leads his book group on the life divine is, mm-hmm. I think, very, you know, very fine. I kind of like to see our workshop with you just continuing as long as it can.
Thank you. I can. I must assure you that I will not like to go beyond at the most 10 such sessions with you.
Okay.
Okay. Is that a good measure for all the members here?
Kiritbhai, actually, yeah. If somebody wants to say something about it, they are welcome. But I think you don't need to feel constrained with any number of a limited number of sittings on this, Kiritbhai, because I also feel that we have embarked on this journey with a completely open sort of ocean in front of us. So, you know, it is such an important topic. And it really depends on the state of consciousness of those who are listening to you and to your own inspiration and what and how they would like to, or we would like to collectively develop this. So I would encourage you to just keep yourself open to the possibility of its developing as as it, you know, unfolds itself.
Very well said.
Thank you. Thank you.
He said what I wanted to say, yes.
Yes, this is perfect, and I completely agree with Devashishji. I can make myself available for as long as it needs, as we need to continue this exploration.
Oh, good, good. give me good encouragement.
Yeah, same for me as well, Kirichi. Same for me as well.
Good, good. Thank you.
Also, Kiritbhai, from my knowledge, people are not speaking up. I just wanted to mention that from my personal interactions with all these participants that are gathered around you, they all have a fair amount of reading into all the texts that you have mentioned.
Great.
That we have actually, most of these people have been, we've been studying Life Divine together for quite some time. Also, we have had occasion to study together various parts of synthesis of yoga, as well as most of them have personally studied the synthesis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, the human cycle also, many of us have studied together.
Mm-hmm.
When I was leading study groups at the Sri Aurobindo Center in Los Angeles. And most of them have also read it themselves. So what you have around you are fairly well-formed students of Sri Aurobindo.
Mm-hmm. All
read all the texts to mm-hmm. some good degree. And mm-hmm. so the familiarity is fairly good. I think the level at which you are pitching your discussions, Kiritbhai, is very, very nice. And I think everybody appreciates them very much because it is extremely, sort of cogent, and it brings us into engagement with the real issues of what our problems today are. And as you said, mm-hmm. provide the background for the full reception of Sri Aurobindo's writing.
Good. Well, I'll try to do then my best, and I'll continue. All right,
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, sure. Because I feel very happy myself to be talking about this. And gives me a... Yes, it gives me great opportunity to learn once again to go through these works. Yes.
So I wanted to, since we have a little time left, I wanted to make one more comment. Regarding what your today's sort of lecture, and one of is very wonderful. I was mentioning that one aspect of what you addressed us with today was this beautiful sweep of Western philosophy in a nutshell, pointing out how the problem of rationality and its various dimensions have been covered through the history of modern Western philosophy. I also wanted to touch briefly on this issue of postmodernism and what today regarding the sort of ultra-relativism of postmodernism.
I missed two sentences.
Yeah, you faded out.
Oh, I was saying that the problem of postmodernism, ultra-relativism.
Yes.
Which is...
you spoke of ultra-relativism.
Yes, I was speaking of the... I was speaking of the ultra-relativism as a possibility.
Yes.
And also, as you said, fall into some kind of irrationality. We can see that maybe even in its beginnings, one of the founding figures in postmodernism is Martin Heidegger, and
you know, he's a very brilliant philosopher and can open us to spiritual directions as well. There is a fatal flaw in his, you know, in his life. I mean, people talk about a lot, which is that he became a member of the Nazi party. So we can see that, you know, all his philosophy could not prevent him from going in that false direction. But also, I think as a result of that, the postmodern philosophers that have followed Heidegger have been very conscious and critical of this particular aspect. So that there is a critique within postmodernism itself, particularly against any form of dogma or any form of social control by rational or. Yeah, I was saying that maybe even within the movement of postmodernism, there is a purificated pulse, and what I was saying that maybe there is an internal movement within the form of philosophy itself,
Not so bad.
Purification, it has to be seen how far it will lead out of you know, what we might call an ultra-relativism and the possibility of... Yes, that was all, Kiripai. I
lost it, too.
No, I lost you, but I would like to comment on what you said. Can I?
Yes, please.
You know, I think that if you all agree, we could... spend some time next time on a brief survey that you can make on the history of reason from modern times to postmodernism, and in the light of the claims of religion and the claims of spirituality, because it is a subject on which we all need to go into some depth to be able to understand how to come out of the impasse. Even if you understood where the impasse is, you see, the impasse is that reason has led to the present condition. And reason is now not able to move forward as it ought to, or as it can. And even if it can and ought to, it still needs a suprarational light. Now, this is the basic point that we need to be precise about. And that can be done if, for example, you have made a very good study of postmodernism, which I have not, but I would like to learn from you something more about it, and maybe that we can have a short discussion on what is reason exactly, what is rationality, and what is spirituality. It will be a good subject. It will put subject if, for example, we have one session only on this subject, what is rationality, and how we can, where it is arrested, why it is arrested, and how it can move forward. Can you hear me?
I think that would be wonderful. Yes, I can hear you. I think that would be wonderful. I will not presume to give... whole background, but I can say a few words next time.
All right.
On the movement of postmodernism and how it addresses the issue of rationality, and as well as of irrationality, both these.
All right.
Then we can proceed from there.
Devashish, can I just add one thing?
Yes, Rich. I think Rich wants to say something, Kirij.
Because, you know, we're talking about postmodernism and the relativism of knowledge, and I'd just like to point out that
That's just one part of the postmodernist program. The other part is a critique of power and power structures, and chief among them is a critique of this whole power structure of what we're calling machinery here. For the next time, Debashish, if we can also consider not just the limitations of rationality, but Sri Aurobindo talks about a progressive evolution. And one could look back and see during the time he was writing that notions of progress were wed to the idea of evolution. And, of course, since the two wars, progress sort of led us onto the abyss of total destruction, there's been a huge critique in postmodernism regards this notion of progress or of progressive evolution. And perhaps that could be something else that we touch on next time, how one sort of, works with this idea of progressive evolution